Okay, some of you may not have seen the morning paper yet, and I wanted to make sure that you did. There's a cartoon strip called Foxtrot. Some of you may have seen Foxtrot from time to time. The little boy in the family is standing at the foot of the stairs, shouting upstairs to his parents, saying, "Mom, Dad, shouldn't we be leaving for church?" Second panel, "You don't want us to be late, do you?" Third panel, "The service starts in 2 hours. Who knows how long it'll take to park?" Fourth panel, "I'll be waiting in the car." Fifth panel shows the father a towel around his waist, shaving. Standing to his right is the mother, brushing her teeth. And the father says, "He really thinks Palm Sunday means free handheld computers, doesn't he?" Palm Sunday does mean more than that. I wanted to also mention that in the time in the first class, there was a moment when we were talking about Will Hahn that it was pointed out, as some of you may have seen, if you know him and saw him a week or two ago, that in the last little while he has lost 40 pounds. His sleep apnea is cured. He is no longer snoring. He's no longer needing the device that he was using for sleep apnea. At which point, my wife said, "I guess you don't need the apparatus anymore, because we had it for a while." And I simply wanted to say there may be a list developing, and if any of you want to be on that list, let us know. Don't sweat it. Don't sweat it. You don't want to know. You don't want to know. In any event, it was a good moment. Now, my students accuse me, they're dead right, of putting all of the important things for the day in the last 5 or 10 minutes of class. Okay? That's right. That's the way you do it. So I want to tell you up front, we are looking at 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 1 through 3. That's what we're looking at. That's what's next. But in order for us to understand the context of this, it's necessary for us to back up and make one more run through verses 13 through 25 in the first chapter of 1 Peter. And since we've already been through this, what I'm doing is I'm going back and picking out one particular thing. And what I want to do is set the stage for that, then talk about that, and let that lead us into the things that we need to talk about in chapter 2, verses 1, 2, and 3. All right, that's the plan for today. So, when you take a look at chapter 1, verses 13 through 25, and you look at it the right way, what you realize is that the writer is giving you two pictures. He's giving you a picture of a Christ-less life, and he's giving you a picture of the Christ-filled life. What's the difference between Easter and Christmas? At Christmas, what are we celebrating? We're celebrating the promise of what's coming. At Easter, we're celebrating the real thing. The big moment of the Christian year is Easter. Our world is sort of beginning to move around a bit on that, which maybe is just as well. All the foo-for-all happens at Christmas time, and maybe we can have a little bit more concentrated effort on thinking about what the Bible's really talking about and what the Lord is really trying to say at Easter. But the essence of Easter is that the work that Jesus did made it possible for God's Spirit to come and live in my heart and in your heart. And it made it possible for us to live a life that Christ fills, as opposed to a life that's empty of Christ. And so it's very appropriate that we talk about these things today. Now, this is not the only place that it's talked about. And so what I want to do is I want to go look at a couple of other places that talk about the same thing, get a good look at those, and then come back into this with that as the background. So I want you to go first to 2 Timothy, Don't lose your place in 1 Peter. We will come back here. But I want you to take a look in 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3. There was a bookmark that was left on the floor last week. It's tilted up against the wall on the little wooden rack just above the left-hand table. If that happens to be yours, come get it. But if you have a bookmark, you can put it in your Bible to hold the place in 1 Peter. Now, I'm looking at 2 Timothy. I want you to look at chapter 3. And I want to begin with verse 1. My translation says, "You may be quite sure that in the last days there will be some difficult times." And then in the next few verses, he begins to describe what is going to be characteristic of people who are living a life in which Christ is not present and not active. And I want you to take a look at the list. The list is fairly long. In my translation, things are broken up with the use of the word "and" or the use of semicolons. I don't know if they're broken up the same way in yours. But my translation starts out in verse 2. People will be, and then it has four phrases, four pictures. Self-centered is the first one. Avaricious, boastful. I'm sorry, self-centered and avaricious. The second line, still in verse 2, says boastful, arrogant, and rude. And then there's a semicolon in my translation. If you see great the same way, that's great. I sort of need to know whether you do or don't. Does yours have those phrases in there? It just has the words all stacked up. Just the words all stacked up. Okay. What I want to know is what other words yours uses for those. What other word is used in place of arrogant? Yours has both words. Okay, so maybe yours is using proud as an alternative for one of those. Okay, so I never know exactly where to put these. I found out this morning that the word ungrateful seems to pop up about four different places depending on which translation you have. In one case it's real early, in one case it's sort of in the middle, and in the third case it's sort of toward the end. So you may see that in a number of different places. I don't know, yours may already have that in this verse. I think the first hour somebody had a translation that had that pretty early. Okay. Yeah, that's quite a different word, and that doesn't show up. Okay. If you keep going into verse 3, there's another set. How does yours start off, verse 3? Well, that's what I'm looking for. Now, let me read all the way through mine. Mine says, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, irreligious, heartless, intractable. They will be slanderers, profligates, savages, and enemies of everything that is good. They will be treacherous, reckless, demented by pride, preferring their own pleasure to God. And then there's a wonderful picture of this in verse 5 that I'll hold for a minute or two. What I'm trying to do is get some words up here that let you see what they're talking about.
After the boastful crowd of Jesus, where there's an intention of pursuing the disobedience
of their parents. Okay, mine moves that over into verse 3.
Disobedient.
The parents. Okay. Now yours says unholy. That's interesting. My translation says irreligious. And I was told that there was at least one translation in the first hour anyway that said unreligious. Do you have one that says that? It may have been somebody having a translation. What's the difference? Let's assume for a moment that these have some validity. What's the difference between unreligious and irreligious? What would unreligious mean? standing apart from religion, just discarding it and ignoring it entirely. What does irreligious sound like? Hostile to it. Actively opposing or ridiculing or whatever. Okay? The commentators that I've consulted, that's more the meaning of what's here. And you see that show up a little bit later. Mine says, heartless and intractable. Wherever it is, it's in that little phrase. Okay, so that's maybe a replacement for this. Inhumane. Somebody made an interesting point this morning. Another point that Saddam Hussein could probably be described by a lot of these words.
Unforgiving.
Now, the words sort of go on from there. I think at this point what I want to ask is, if there's a word that jumps out at you as particularly powerful, let's make sure we get that word up there. And then I want to go on to verse 5. Anything between verse 2 and verse 4 that jumps out at you is really significant. Maybe we've got enough already. Maybe we need to add. Yeah, boy, that's a good way of... I think that fits with this one. Swollen with conceit. Is that the New Living Translation? Swollen with conceit. Proud, arrogant.
Thank you.
Self-centered. This is a big one. I like that translation.
Yeah.
Now, verse 5 is powerful. And yeah, that's this one. There's at least one translation that starts off with lovers of self, lovers of money. Okay. That's what life is like. It's what. Now, look at verse 5, because verse 5 begins to sum this up. I don't particularly like my translation, but I know what it's trying to say. There is a translation out that's a little bit better than this one. But mine says, they keep up the outward appearance of religion, but reject the inner power of it. Keep away from people like that. How does yours read that? The words are form and appearance. They have the form or appearance of godliness. But rejecting the inner power of it. Okay. Now, if you move down for just a moment to verse 10, my translation says, you, though. Some translation says, you, on the other hand, or you, in contrast, or you, however. And this is where the other one comes in. You have followed my teaching, my way of life, my aims, my faith, my patience, my love, my perseverance, and the way that I endure persecution and suffering. Sort of the middle of that, the tail end of that, is not a bad list. Faith, love, patience, perseverance, the ability to endure persecution for my faith. This last one modern Americans don't know too much about. Ken Eels, who attends the first hour, was on a trip to Southeast Asia. We actually ended up a little worried about him as to whether he was going to have SARS, because he had been in Hong Kong at about the right time. But he came back from that trip. He had been in China for a number of days, spending time with Chinese Christians. And he said it became very obvious very quickly that there were some severe penalties for expressing anything about faith out loud in a public setting in China. The jail sentences and such were fairly common. And he said, I found myself when I was with some of these Christians, and they were just openly speaking to people in public places about their faith. He said, I found myself reaching over and saying, shh, tone it down. And he suddenly realized that what he was seeing someone who's courageous. And he said, that's not something I had a whole lot of experience with. And this is a fairly experienced missionary observing this. Now, yeah.
A lot of the churches that are popping up, a lot of the underground churches are coming up to the forefront. They have 100% former Muslim background, believers in Christ, leadership, 5 years old, and they are the whole witnesses of Christ. Mm-hmm. The church has no clue what they're called.
Mm-hmm.
Just really, truly standing and being martyred. Mm-hmm. And not ashamed to share it with you.
Verses 14 and 15, I'm not going to take a whole lot of time on this. But they speak of being characterized by seeking after or searching true wisdom. And it talks about some of the ways that that can be accomplished. Now, I want to jump for a moment to a second example. So if you back up some more into the...
Before you do that,
yeah.
I want to ask a question. Yeah. Okay. In verse 5, it says, you're full
heart of
you. I'm supposed to find a reason, but I'm not going to avoid such people if we do. Where does that mean? How can we avoid people like that? I don't know. It's just a question for us to think about.
Well, hang on a second. It's not a bad idea to take yourself back to what Jesus did. Who did Jesus hang out with? He was not hanging out with the chief priests and the scribes and the Pharisees. He wasn't hanging out with the people who were keeping the outward form of religion but rejecting the inner power of it. He was hanging out with people who realized something was missing and were hungry. That's the people he was hanging out with. Even there, I think an example can be made. There are people who are all of this who haven't done that. And I think that the juncture about staying away from people like that, in my own sense, I think that stays strictly on verse 5. Because if you talk about this, that won't work. I think it's talking about people who have come into the body and who say, we are Christians, we are believers, but who have rejected the inner power of it. There's a danger there. I described the church that we were once part of as having 5,000 names on the roll and having about 300 active members. When you see people who are going through the motions, but who have a sense of what Christianity is all about and keep the form but reject the inner power. I can't improve on the wording. That's the danger. But I think that's the main danger being talked about. I don't think it backs all the way up to here, because otherwise you're right. The rejection would be somewhat close to total. special kind. Yeah, a special kind. The ones that claim to have all the answers but reject what the answers actually say. I see. And if you look at Jesus' life, I think you see that. But when he spent time with Pharisees, when he spent time with scribes, it typically were the ones who had a question. Now, sometimes they had a question because they were trying to trap him, but if you sort of picture a group of people, the one that had the boldness to go and actually ask the question might have been the one who realized maybe that's a question worth answering. And he would spend time with people who had questions. But he wouldn't spend a whole lot of time with people who thought they had all the answers and didn't need him. At least that's the model I see. Okay? Back up to Galatians. This is the more powerful of the two examples I'm going to show you. This is Galatians chapter 5. And in Galatians chapter 5, they don't use this phrase. Paul doesn't use this phrase. Paul uses the phrase led by the Spirit. And instead of Christ's left life, which isn't used in here, he uses a phrase that says yield to, and then in my translation it says self-indulgence, and that really doesn't, I think, communicate very well. Base desires are sometimes used. Anybody have another translation? No, because you don't know where to look yet. Take a look at chapter 5, verse 16. Chapter 5, verse 16. Let me read it in my translation. I want to start with verse 15. If you go snapping at one another and tearing one another to pieces, take care. You'll be eaten up by one another. Verse 16. Instead, I tell you, be guided by the Spirit. Be led by the Spirit. And you will no longer yield to, my translation says, self-indulgence. What's your phrase at the end of that if it's better? Yeah. Lust of the flesh, I think, doesn't speak quite as well to us as sinful nature maybe does. There's a sense in which we still have a sinful nature when the Spirit comes in. And Paul talks at some places about warfare still going on. Now, what I want to do is take a look at the lists. There's two lists. Have you noticed anything about the two lists you have up here so far? Anybody notice anything about that? What did you say?
Short and long.
It doesn't take too long to talk about the big points over here, but the list over here just almost seems endless. Okay? Now, one of the problems with that is if enough of this gets going, it starts to crowd these out. If you simply get rid of these and there's nothing there, they're probably going to crowd back in. There's so many different forms that this takes. There's a wonderful parable that Jesus tells about a woman who had a demon possession, and the demon was driven out. And it says, the demon wandered for many days in wilderness places and came back, found the place it had been, swept and tidied but empty, went and found seven more demons worse than the original one, and the woman was worse off at the end than she was at first. You can't fix things spiritually by emptying the list over here. That's why the word is used. You can only do it by filling with these. Okay? So let's look at the list in here. I won't take time to write them all down. Maybe I won't write down any. But if you come along, it says in verse 17, the desires of self-indulgence are always in opposition to the Spirit. The desires of the Spirit are in opposition to self-indulgence. They are opposites, one against the other. Now, you just said it four times. Did you pick that up? The desires of self-indulgence are always in opposition to the Spirit. He turns it backwards. The desires of the Spirit are in opposition to self-indulgence. He summarizes. They are opposites. He says it again, one against the other. That's how you're prevented from doing the things you want to do. And then in verse 19, when self-indulgence, that's again not the phrase in my translation, is at work, the results are obvious. And once again, the word and semicolons are used in my translation to sort of block this out a little bit. Sexual vice, impurity, and sensuality, the worship of false gods and sorcery, antagonisms and rivalry, jealousy, bad temper and quarrels, disagreements, factions and malice, drunkenness, orgies, and all those things people who behave in those ways will not inherit the kingdom of God. Were any things in your list significantly different from my list, or significantly sort of jump off the page after you, we should add it up here? Is there anything in your list that jumped out? These aren't real attractive lists, and I think you're right. This is not confined to one person who used to be in Iraq. This is loose in our world, and most of it's something that we deal with. Okay. When you come to the second part in verse 22, my translation starts out, on the other hand. You could say in contrast. I think yours just said but. Yeah. I like on the other hand. The fruit of the Spirit, and then it has nine terms. Most commentators divide those up into blocks of three, so we'll do that. Love, joy, and peace. I think my translation says patience, kindness, and goodness. Yours may have a slightly different order. Patience, kindness, goodness. Okay. Faithfulness, mine says trustfulness. I like yours better. Faithfulness, good, gentleness, and self-control. Faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. We ought to take time to talk about all those we did when we went through Galatians. We're not going to do it again. I do want to point out something to you. First of all, if you take a look at the front end of this, it says this is the fruit of the Spirit. It probably bears commenting on it for just a moment. What does that phrase mean? What was the pastor preaching about before the pastor went off to Honduras? Vine and fruit. Right? Is this that fruit? I'll offer my opinion. No, it's not. Says so. This is not my fruit. Whose fruit is this? This is the fruit of the Spirit. If the Spirit is allowed to work in me, this is what the Spirit will produce. But I'm supposed to produce fruit. That's what John 15 talks about. We'll talk about a little bit other places. What's the fruit I produce? Change lives. My witness brings people to where they start to listen to what the Spirit has to say, and they become children of God. That's the fruit I produce. Now, I don't know that it's real important that you adopt that point of view. That's just the one I've adopted. This is the fruit that the Spirit produces if I allow the Spirit to begin to work in my life. If this fruit isn't being produced, there's not much chance I'm going to produce much fruit. So they are absolutely connected. But one is what we allow the Spirit to do inside of us. The other is then what the Lord is able to do through us. The one is in us. The one is through us. And I see that as sort of the distinction that's been made. Okay? The second thing I want to point out is the tail end of this. This is at the end of verse 23. In my translation, this list falls over. The first, the last few fall over into the front end of verse 23. A rough translation of this says, they don't write laws about things like this. They don't write laws about things like this. They write laws about murder. They write laws about assault. They write laws about slander. They write laws about trickery. They write laws about abuse. They don't write laws about gentleness. They don't write laws about joy. The laws aren't written about these things. And I think if you ponder that a little bit, it really starts to come alive. Now, this is sort of the backdrop, and what I want to do is see if you can spot in 1 Peter a similar kind of list. The 1 Peter list is interesting because it's much shorter. It puts three or four things on each side, and that's all. And so I think it's important for you to have some sense of the larger lists that are out there. Okay? In 1 Peter chapter 14, 1 Peter chapter 1, First Peter chapter 1, back off guys, First Peter chapter 1, verse 14. My translation says, don't allow yourselves to be shaped. Now, we already talked about this. That's why I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time here. We already talked about this. Don't allow yourselves to be shaped. Shaped by what? Well, shaped by this kind of stuff. That's what he's talking about. Shaped by this kind of stuff. And he uses two phrases for that. So, let us find those. What's the first one? I'm going to go all the way to the end of the verse and pick up the first one. I'm sorry. Yeah, the end of the verse. My translation says ignorance. Do you spot that for a word like that? Okay. Christ's last life, more than anything, is characterized by ignorance. Now, I want to ask you the question I ask my students in the first of every semester when I'm teaching them the first year course. Is ignorance the same as stupidity? Absolutely not. What does stupidity mean? Can't learn. What does ignorance mean? You haven't learned. You are unaware of. You're living your life in the absence of this kind of thing. So what is it people are ignorant of? More than anything, this kind of life, Christ's blessed life, is characterized by ignorance on two points. It, when I say two points, it's not one and the other. It takes this form or it takes that form. Either people think God is unknowable, or they think God is not worth knowing. It may take the form of thinking there's no God at all. That's fairly recent. But either God is unknowable, there isn't such a thing, might be a form of that if you wanted to stretch it that far. Or, he's not worth knowing. That's what they're ignorant about. Because God is knowable. He wants us to know who he is. And he is supremely worth knowing. Now what's the second one? Second one is translated in a word in my translation that says passions. But there are some translations out there that are better. No volunteers? You got verse 14? Yeah. And what I want to do is I want to enlarge that just a little so you can see what they're talking about. That kind of life, Christ's last life, is characterized by ignorance. It's characterized by being dominated by selfish desire. I want what I want when I want it. There's no reason I shouldn't have it. Greed and arrogance tie together. And it's really interesting. The gospel writers, the New Testament writers, speak of greed and arrogance as equating to idolatry in the Old Testament. Greed is an attitude that says, I deserve something. That greed is an attitude that says, I want something I don't have. And arrogance is an attitude that says, I deserve to have it. And I deserve to have it even if I have to take it from you. Life dominated by selfish desires. The last one, the third one, is down in verse 18. 18, verse 18 is one of those wonderful verses in the New Testament. But in the middle of it is a phrase or a word that is just horrible. And I want to make sure you see it. Let me read verse 18 in my translation. For you know that the price of your ransom from the futile way of life handed down from your ancestors was paid not in anything perishable like silver or gold, continuing in verse 19, but in precious blood as of a spotless and blameless lamb, Jesus Christ. Did you hear the horrible word in the middle? That kind of life, a Christ-less life, is characterized by futility. For you know that the price of your ransom from the futile way of life handed down to you from your ancestors was paid not in anything perishable like silver or gold, but in precious blood, as of a blameless and spotless lamb, Jesus Christ. Life going nowhere. nothing for which to live, nothing worth dying for, nothing worth living for, nothing worth dying for. And more than anything, the essence of futility is the attitude that life ends with death. There's nothing on the other side of death. This week, on the Christian calendar, we celebrate the opposite of death. We celebrate the affirmation that life is found reaching for what's on the other side of death, reaching for the Lord who calls us home. Who was Solomon in the Old Testament? Rich and wise king. Well, you know, they say that. There's some evidence that points in the other direction. How many wives did the poor guy have? Hundreds. And then women that were called concubines, and at least triple the number. And if you go into Kings, hundreds of years later, you find that there's all kinds of stuff going on. The kinds of things going on within the temple. Male and female prostitution in the name of religion inside the temple. And it all started with Solomon trying to placate and satisfy some of his wives. I'm not sure how wise he was. I think he was handed wisdom and never knew what to do with it. That's why it's so important here, seeking after true wisdom. That's why I put that word down there. He was given the wisdom but didn't use it. What things did Solomon write that ended up in the Bible? Song of Solomon. Proverbs. Good. That's what I figured you would name first. He also wrote Ecclesiastes. Now, in the King James Version, the opening phrases of Ecclesiastes say like this: vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And that's a terrible word for modern Americans because you don't know what that word means. So modern translations will often say it this way: futility, futility, all is futility. Ecclesiastes is the song of a person who is caught in this life, a Christless life, and has gotten a glimpse of something different but hasn't figured out how to find it. In my opinion, it's one of the most tragic books in the Old Testament. Yours says meaningless, meaningless. Okay? Futility, futility. Life isn't futile. It has a purpose. And how horrible it is to live life without a purpose. Now, set alongside this, are some things out of a Christ-filled life. And once again, there are three, even if I can't write a three in the second, a two in the proper way. I want to take you first back to verse 15. I'm still in 1 Peter chapter 1. Do not allow yourself to be shaped by the passions of your old ignorance. My translation, verse 15, but as obedient children, be yourselves holy in all of your activity after the model of the Holy One who calls us. The two phrases that come out go together: obedience and holiness. We are called in a Christ-filled life to live a life of obedience and holiness. What does the word holy mean? I want to just make sure. We've actually talked about this either last time or the time before. What does the word holy mean? It means set apart. And not just set apart in the sense of put over there as opposed to put over here, but set apart for special service. Set apart, in the context here says, set apart for special service to God. God is different, and we're called upon to be different. So the word could be translated as different, but different for a purpose. It could be called set apart, but set apart for a purpose.
Set apart and called apart from that. We know that life. We write so much about it, but Christ calls us and teaches us to a life like this.
Uh-huh. And the things that are here you're not going to find those very well if you haven't realized what it is you're doing. God calls you to be different. He calls you to be set apart for His service. And the first, the foundational step in that direction is obedience. There was a baptism in the 8 o'clock service. That's the only service I ever see around here anymore. There was a baptism in the 8 o'clock service. I don't know how old the person was. I think he was probably at least 55, maybe a little bit older. And when they said why he was baptized, they didn't get it out quite right, but they came pretty close. And I understood what they meant. Because here's what they said. He's been a Christian a very long time, but he wants to be baptized. The usual reason for that appears to be the reason in his case. He was not baptized as a believer. He was baptized before he became a believer. I'm not positive of that, but I think that's what happened. So, being baptized as a believer is something he had never had the experience of doing. So why did he do it? The easy answer is because our church wouldn't let him become a member if he didn't. But I think that doesn't really get at the heart of it. Gets at the heart of it is he did it to be obedient. God calls on his children to mark their belief with a public act of witness, which is baptism. And our church was given the privilege of being the one to perform that for him and with him. Obedience is at the heart of holiness. We are set apart. We're different. How are we different? Because we obey. And when we obey, these things become inconsistent. Let's take it one step further. Verse 17. And if you address as Father him who judges without favoritism according to each individual's deeds, live out the time of your exile here in reverent awe. Reverence. God is not a chum. And God loves people. But that's not an excuse for a libertine way of life. God is a judge. There will be a day of reckoning. We will stand before the one who judges. If we are believers, the way we stand and where we stand is going to be a little different. But there still is a time of reckoning for everybody. I live my life different from the way people here lead their lives. If my life is Christ-filled, I live my life in reverence because I know who the judge is. And I know that the day of reckoning is coming, and I live my life in knowledge of that. I also live my life in knowledge that this is not where I live. Did you hear the word exile in there? This is not my home. I'm here for now, but my home is someplace else. We talked about this for the last few weeks. And my reverence and awe of the Lord. Some translations even use the word fear, and that's okay. The proverb says the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. But there's also multiple places in Scripture that says, once you learn to fear the Lord, what's the next thing the Lord's going to say to you? Fear not. Fear not.
So we don't automatically get rid of all of this way
of life. I mean, read it out of maybe it's in Galatians. It's in one of those two places. Let me see if I can find it real quickly. Yeah. The desires of self-indulgence are always in opposition to the Spirit. The desires of the Spirit are in opposition to self-indulgence. They are opposites one against that big four-part hammering, right? This is the phrase that follows. This is how you are prevented from doing the things you want to do. Paul said there's a warfare going on in my body. And as long as we're on this side, that warfare is still there. Okay. Now, there is a last one in Peter. And this is the new part. This is the one part that we have not talked about before. This is verse 24. Everything else we've been through before. Everything. No, we're not. Remember, where are we headed? We're headed for chapter 2, verse 1, right? Yeah. And no, I've still got 7 minutes. So I've got 2 minutes to finish up the first. I want to go to verse 22. Since by your obedience to the truth, you have purified yourselves, you can now experience the genuine love of the brothers. So love each other intensely from the heart. What's the third thing that characterizes? I'm going to add the word sisters to that phrase because I think it fits. Learning how to love the other people that have the Spirit in their hearts. If I've got God's Spirit in my heart and you've got God's Spirit in your heart, we ought to at least figure out how to love each other, even if we're still struggling with everything else. John 15, John 16, John 17, on the Lord's last night on this side of the on that side of the cross, he said two things that were very powerful. He said, by your love for one another, they'll know that you're Christians. You haven't figured out how to love each other. The world's going to assume you're not Christian. They won't be right, but they'll be forming correct conclusions based on the evidence you're presenting to them. He said, may they be one. You figure out a way to live in unity, not uniformity, but in unity. Because by your unity, people will know that God sent me. If we haven't figured out how to work together, how to love each other, the world's going to conclude Jesus isn't the Messiah. They'll be wrong, but they'll be forming the right conclusions based on the evidence we're presenting. So this is a key piece to lots of scriptures, some of the most important scriptures that are out there, loving for brothers and sisters. And here's what I want you to see. When you go to chapter 2, verse 1, that is still the subject. It's that last piece, loving the brothers and sisters. We're not even trying to extend it to loving the whole world. Just loving each other within the body. Because here's what he says in chapter 2, verse 1. He says, strip off. He says, rid yourselves. He says, put aside. And what does he say to put aside? There's five words there in my translation. The first word is the big one. And it is terribly translated in my translation. It's translated as spite. That's a terrible, terrible translation. It's too mild. It's too mild. Malice gets better. You remember malicious back over here somewhere? I don't know if I wrote it down, but did you hear it go by over there? The word, I'm told, is a word that talks about, it's a word I don't hear very often anymore. It talks about wickedness. Evil. The evil that's sometimes loose in the world. Wickedness. A long time ago, we lived in a very modest neighborhood, and we had a family whose house backed up to ours, and their children played with our children. And one day the mother of one of that couple was murdered by the Briley brothers. The Briley brothers. If you've lived in Richmond a while, you'll know who I'm talking about. I have a friend from those days who was assistant or associate warden at the big state pen downtown when they still brought the people on death row to Richmond. And he told me one time, I've talked with those people. You look in their eyes, and there's almost nothing human there. There is an evil that is so deep, I can't tell you what it's like. Now this morning, in my bulletin, I had a little insert. It talked about trying to help offenders get restored. My warden friend says, there's some people you just don't want on the street. Because that's taken over so much. That's the word. Evil that's deep. And then all the other words are modifiers. They're descriptors of details of it. And now, those are the words I want you to take a good hard look at. Because these are the ones that sometimes creep up. What's the first one? We got very little time. What's the first one? Deceit. What does that mean? Well, let me get the second word out there to make sure you don't get the wrong answer. What's the second word? I don't know if I spelled that right. Hypocrisy. What's the difference between deceit and hypocrisy? Hypocrisy means what? I'm going to try to fool you about who I am. What's deceit? I'm going to try to trick you about the way things are. And what's the purpose for the first of us? What's the purpose for deceit? The purpose for deceit is I can get what I want. I'm going to try to confuse you about the way things are. I'm going to try to trick you about how things are working, about what the conditions really are, in order that I can have my way or achieve my aims or get what I want. Hypocrisy says, I'm going to appear to be something I'm not. because I want the status, or I want the results of that. Go back to here, when you heard that second one. Take on the form of godliness, but reject the inner power of it. Okay. What's the third one? The third and fourth need to come together. Envy, and what's the last one? Envy. Now, the fourth one, I've got to put up here because there's several words. I want to give you my translation first. My translation says carping criticism. Carping criticism. There's another translation, and I think it matches a translation somebody had back over in here, malicious gossip. From my standpoint, maybe that's a word that only existed in East Tennessee. Carping basically means it doesn't matter what's going on. I'm in there throwing things out to try to confuse things and get things all stirred up and get people mad at each other.
Spreading negativity.
Mm-hmm. Somebody said this morning what the difference is between gossip and malicious gossip is. Gossip's true. You just probably shouldn't have said it. Malicious gossip most of the time isn't true, or it's overblown or something else, and you've said it deliberately in order to hurt somebody. Okay. What's envy? Envy is, I can't stand it when something good happens to you. Now, I want to close with that one. Something happened within the last 2 weeks, and it just about blew me away. I don't think I've seen anything like this in a decade. I got to set the context for you. Most of you will have heard of Rhodes Scholarships. Some of those prestigious scholarships that can go to college students in the U.S. Fewer of you, but still some, will have heard of Marshall Scholarships. There's something like that. You may not have heard of Goldwater Scholarships. They're congressionally mandated. They're put in place on a state-by-state system, and they're designed, like the other two, to give recognition and prestige to people who have been high achievers in a college setting. The difference about the Goldwater Scholarships is they're focused on students who are aimed at careers as scientists and mathematicians and things like that. It's the one of those three that's very, very focused. That probably is why most people haven't heard of it. It also doesn't involve a trip overseas. Okay? It's a big deal to get a Goldwater. Colleges in the U.S. nominate, and then if you're nominated, you're put into a pool with all the other people from your home state. So Richmond may be in Virginia, but unless a student is from Virginia, they'll compete wherever their state is. We nominated three people this year. Two of them got it. 10 days ago, the one who didn't get the scholarship came running into my office with this huge grin, and he said, Dr. Myers, Kristen and Brian got the scholarship. Isn't that great? Are you as stunned as I was? Where was envy? It wasn't there. Where was, wait a minute, why did I get recognized? It wasn't there. I was stunned. I'm not used to seeing that. He was delighted because something good had happened to his friend. He got passed over. And that wasn't on the table. He wasn't seeing that. Brian and Kristen got the award. Isn't that great? Now, I got to tell you, you can build a community off the attitude that kid has. You can build a community that's tight and supportive and fantastic off the attitude that kid has. But you try to take the other attitude, and it tears community apart. Here's what I'm trying to say. The whole idea of a Christ-filled life is filling the first chapter. And when you come into it, they pick the one thing that is the heart. It's not that this is the key. The key is back here with obedience and holiness. This is what the world sees. And these are the things that can prevent from being achieved. We are called on to live a Christ-filled life. Let's have a word of prayer. Our Father, we thank you for your Son, and at this time of year especially, we remember his sacrifice for us. We thank you for the love that you've had for us, the love that caused you to do such a great and wonderful thing. Teach us the difference it makes to live with your Spirit in our hearts, or to live with nothing in our hearts. Call us closer and closer to you. Help us realize that we're to be set apart for special service. Show us what that service is. Prepare us for it. All this we pray in your Son's name. Amen. Thank you.